You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, we are talking food and politics with Willie Geist, co-anchor of MSNBC's Morning Joe and the anchor of Sunday Today with Willie Geist, and also Alex Wagner, editor at The Atlantic and former host of Now with Alex Wagner on MSNBC. But before we get to that, I just want to let you know that we have relaunched the Epicurious app, Epicurious Recipes and Food Videos, it's called. There are now 90 brand new recipe videos in 10 new series, including one of three ingredient Thanksgiving dishes you can make this year. Thanksgiving's happening. It's coming up, right? And the best part, the app will be updated every single day. Head to iTunes and you can download it now. Another thing, for the first time, we're hoping to get your voices, the listeners of this podcast, on our show. In a couple of weeks, we'll be airing our Thanksgiving Spectacular, which also happens to be the podcast's two-year anniversary. For the next week or so, we'll be taking your most pressing Thanksgiving questions via voicemail. Hosting for the first time? Scared of pie? Want to make something other than traditional mashed potatoes? You can call 929-265-8033. That's my radio voice. Once again, 929-265-8033. Leave us a message letting us know what your query is, and then tune in to hear if food editor Carla Lolly Music answers your questions. And once again, finally, that's 929-265-8033. All right, let's do this. Let's talk food and politics with Willie and Alex. All right, guys, we are recording this a week from the election, exactly 1 week. And I feel like I don't even, is it fair to say that I don't know who's going to be president?
It's fair to say that you don't know, but I think the rest of us know.
Really?
I don't. It would be very surprising if he became president. And that's not in my opinion. That's a look at data inside the states, the five or six states that will decide the election. And the other thing is, the email story that blew up on Friday and is now in its fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth days didn't really move the meter. You know, it's such a partisan issue that it was a huge deal for Republicans, and I don't think it was the worst thing in the world. Not a big deal at all for Democrats.
But you know who it's, you know, it's huge with? Foodies.
Foodies.
Yes.
Huge.
Foodies all over the world rock their socks off.
The foodie swing vote is going to decide this election.
Because they vote as a bloc.
Exactly.
Very unified.
Very monolithic.
It's not impossible, but it's highly unlikely that Donald Trump will be president.
I agree with that, Willie.
Did you see this thing about a few weeks ago? Do you ever follow Pete Wells, the New York Times restaurant critic?
I follow his writing. I don't follow him on the social media.
On the Twitter. And someone brought up that they had never seen, a waiter said, I've been working in New York City restaurants for 15 years now. I've never seen Donald Trump out and about at a New York City restaurant. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. A, because I do think restaurants these days more than ever perhaps are where you do sort of get seen. And Obama, Alex, you know this, has made a point of going to the cool restaurants.
Well, I think his reason for going to restaurants is twofold. One, I think he and his wife like to eat and try
every
food,
day.
Right? But I also think it's a break from being inside the White House, which by all accounts is a pretty insular existence. And it's a way of sort of being in the world insofar as he's in a restaurant with other people, even if he's not actually sort of like sitting with them and eating with them. But, so, I mean, Trump not going to a restaurant is really very strange because his children like going to restaurants.
Well, all right. So I did a little bit more research on the Twitter on Pete's, and a lot of people chimed in. And it was interesting. People have seen Trump, but it's like at certain types of restaurants. And it's interesting. Like, I think the restaurant you go to says something a lot about the person you are. And the spottings of Trump were at like Le Cirque a couple of weeks ago, the Ralph Lauren Polo Bar, which I'm a big fan of.
Yes.
One guy saw him like 10 years ago at Tao, and he said he was rather disinterested.
All the places you've just described, I think, are within a 4-block radius of Trump Tower.
In the 50s,
and, yes.
And then the other restaurant, and someone had a great shot through this sort of glass of Bordeaux of him and his wife at 21 Club.
Old school. I'm hearing old school. Right. I'm hearing sort of Vegas-y restaurants. Mm-hmm. And I'm hearing
power.
like holdovers from the 90s, 80s restaurant power scene, like, you know, Le Cirque.
His essence is very of a time. It's very 80s. Everything in Trump Tower is still gold plated. It's mirrored. He is sort of a product of the 80s. And those are probably the restaurants when he was big shit. Can we say shit on this?
Yes, sure.
He was big
sure.
shit in the 80s. those were the places you wanted to be seen. And so those are the places sort of set in his mind, and he still goes. Yeah.
It's interesting, people like that. Like I grew up in the 80s as well, and I was big into like the hair metal in the 80s, you know, late 80s, Warrant, Dawkins.
Trump is apparently also
but you, no, but you see, metal. But you see people like that who like just keeping the dream alive. And you're like, those are my golden years, and damn it, I'm sticking to them. And Trump is like the same thing. He's like, I'm huge in the 80s. I'm going to put gold over everything. I'm going to keep do the hair, the big red tie. Like I'm just like, I'm all about power.
I'm impressed that those restaurants are still around. I mean, you know, the New York restaurant dining scene is like vicious. It's a knife fight in a phone booth. And the idea that Le Cirque is still serving, it says something about Le Cirque. So, you know.
And Le Cirque is on its third location right now because it was originally where Danielle is now. Then it moved to the Palace Hotel, and then now it's in like the Bloom. Ironically, I don't know, ironically or not, but in the Bloomberg Building in the 50s, as you pointed out.
Right. You know what? Those places—they're not the hot restaurants, obviously, but like once a year, they're fun to go to. Like 21 around the holidays—that's a good meal.
Well, 21 is an awesome room. Yeah, if anyone who hasn't been there, and you've seen, you're a smart New York-y sort of guy. Well, you've seen
sort of
sweet smell of success.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. With Burt Lancaster.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, and Tony Curtis, and the scenes shot there where he holds court are basically, you know, it has not changed.
Right.
Also, for those younger than you dinosaurs, there's a very pivotal scene in Sex and the City where Big and Carrie have a dinner at the 21 Club.
The show,
underneath
not the movie. The show.
The show.
Yeah. But there's so many scenes in that show took place at restaurants. And it comes back to, like I said, where you frequent says a lot about you. And it's interesting, getting back to Obama, he went to Estella here in New York, which we in our magazine put as one of our top 10 new restaurants a couple years ago. And it's like it's on East Houston Street, basically in the Lower East Side. In D.C., he's gone to Rose's Luxury, which is like you got to wait 3 hours to get in unless you're the president.
Yeah.
He seems to go to some progressive places.
Well, progressive insofar as they're the cutting edge of, I think, you know, dining and food and trends. I mean, I think
they're
that,
cool.
To be honest, has a lot to do with the First Lady, who's super adventurous when it comes to food. Mm-hmm. I think both of them like eating, and they like conviviality, and they like new stuff. So why not try those things? I mean, I think, you know, Trump's choice of restaurants is evidence of the kind of person he is, which is much more, I mean, his ideas about, I think, culture and change. And I'm trying to think of a way to say this in the sort of, because I think without any judgment, I mean, he's old. I mean, no, truly, he is old school in his choices, and he's very kind of traditional in his choices, and they're not, you know. I mean, this is something that I've marveled at. Like when Obama was running in 2008, I think it was 2008, there was so much uproar around his preference for arugula, and that, you know, Obama somehow embodied this whole foodsy, you know, progressive, wishy-washy Democrat thing. It's not surprising that Trump is decidedly in the other direction, right?
He's pure iceberg all the way.
Yeah, man. Wedge salad. Let's go.
Big wedge with bacon.
I would like to believe there is a land where you can be both. I love arugula.
Yeah, I love wedge salad.
I love a wedge.
But you know what? I love arugula, but if I'm going to the Polo Bar at Ralph Lauren's restaurant, I will order the wedge.
To be clear, that was not an attack on the wedge. It's just an observation. I love the wedge. But sometimes they do the wedge where they pre-cut it for you.
I don't want that.
I want the experience. Yeah. I want to hear my knife go through that crisp
steak knife.
Iceberg.
Your steak knife. Your serrated steak.
Exactly.
This is a question, though. Do you prefer blue cheese on the wedge or ranch?
Blue cheese.
Blue cheese.
I didn't know that was a choice. Who's ever put ranch on a wedge?
Ranch is like if you run out of blue cheese.
You're projecting here and you like the ranch.
Well,
yes.
Don't ask me a question you want to answer.
Let me ask you a question. Who doesn't love the ranch? America loves the ranch.
I like ranch as a dipping option.
You know what? If ranch ran for president, ranch would be kicking ass right now.
Yep,
ranch would be like 9-10 points ahead right now in the
polls. Now, I want the ranch in the middle of the pre-cut vegetables. That I'll give you.
But baby
on
carrots.
Top of the wedge, I want the blue cheese, and I want some crumbled blue cheese with it.
Yeah.
A little heirloom tomatoes. And
maybe a little bacon.
I was positing to you guys via email that in some ways I believe that I'm like a blue state guy, but I have a red state diet.
I understand completely.
Well, and how do you interpret that?
So I went to college in Nashville.
Yeah, Vanderbilt.
To Vanderbilt, Then I lived in Atlanta for 7 years after that. So I spent 10 years, a quarter of my life in the South.
How many times have you been to Houston's?
Constantly. Yeah. And you know what I do now? Because of the Houston's habit I picked up in the South, now on a Sunday afternoon, maybe a little hungover, we will drive from our apartment on the Upper West Side and get the family vehicle out of the garage, drive to Riverside Square Mall in New Jersey.
Wow. Over the GWB?
Over the bridge.
Commitment.
Where there's a Houston's just to get the spinach artichoke dip.
Wow.
They never give you enough chips. You got to get those coming back, but I'm not going to hold them to that.
Wow.
That's how much I like Houston's.
I was coming back from Long Island one time, and I took the bus home. My wife and child were still out there. And I got up, there's that stop on like 41st and 3rd Avenue. It was a nice night, and it was like summer. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to walk for a while. I've been on a bus for 2.5 hours. And I'm starting walking down 3rd Avenue. Then I cut over, and you're in like that weird, you know, Murray Hill area. And next thing I know, I'm like, oh, wow, I'm on Park and 27th. And there's Hillstone, and I'm by myself, and it's like 7:45 on a Sunday night. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go sit at the bar.
Yeah, you are.
And I'm going to like, I'm going to get spinach artichoke dip for myself.
Wow.
Then I'm getting the burger.
Wow.
I'm going through the dip. They bring out extra chips, and I'm like, okay, I'm on vodka soda number 2. I
mean, wow.
By 8:30, I was like drunk and so full.
And it was excellent.
I know. It wasn't even dark out yet.
Can I just suggest hazard a sort of theory here, which is, and Adam, you would know this better than I or Willie, even given our deep, deep understanding of American food. I feel like there's a real trend in American sort of fine dining. I mean, this goes against everything that I just said, but I feel like there's a trend to return to the red state diet. So like the perfection of the American burger is something you're seeing across New York City, right?
Huge.
I mean, and steaks and cocktails. I mean, this is a thing that's happening even among blue staters, is a celebration of and a refinement of the classic, like,
because you know what you're getting. You know what you're getting, especially in, I've posited this as well. I don't use the word posit that often, but I feel like I'm using it a lot today. That especially in economic times where things are a little bit more unstable, people are like, you know what? If I'm going to go out to dinner and spend a lot of money, it better be for something that I know I'm going to like.
Right.
You know? And I know I'm going to like that ribeye steak and the baked potato and the wedge salad.
See,
I know that.
I don't think it's a bad development, though, because the era when you get the big plate with the tiny little thing in the middle of it and
foam.
You weren't quite
we don't
sure
want foam.
You weren't sure what it was. Just give me a good steak.
Yeah, inherited. You know, like people want to know where their food is from and they know want to know what's on their plate. But that is also different than what Trump, for example, who we are categorizing as an institutionalist as far as his food preferences. That's different. He eats a lot of fast food on the trail. A lot. And not just because of necessity, because he legit really enjoys it. And let me tell you, I like fast food too.
Of course.
Well,
I don't know that I could eat it with the same frequency.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about that, because it's interesting. Like right now, so I have an soon-to-be 9-year-old, as Marlon likes to say, 8, soon-to-be 9, quote-unquote. You, Willie, how old are your
nine.
Kids?
9-year-old okay. daughter, 7-year-old son.
I have the mind of a 9-year-old.
Yeah. But it's interesting. So Marlon, he won't even acknowledge McDonald's. He'll just like, they talk at school as if McDonald's is poisonous or something.
Right.
Like, they're just like, no, don't eat, you know, and it's interesting. What is your kid's relationship?
I get that too. I wonder if that's a New York City thing.
They'll go to Shake Shack for their $9 whatever, but.
I think probably when I grew up, McDonald's was a huge treat. Like my parents were like, we eat there, maybe we're on the road on vacation or something. So we've sort of taken that approach. So they don't ask for it. They just think, hey, maybe we'll get this once or twice a year. But they eat pizza. They eat the kids eat.
Well, it's funny. Like the delivery stuff, like delivery pizza or mozzarella sticks are fine. But McDonald's or something, it's like institutional sort of.
Right.
One thing, though, I think, which is what conservative folks, if whatever we're calling that, get annoyed with. And like my mom, speaking of which, there is that preachiness of like, don't preach to me about what's good for me.
Totally.
Anytime I bring up kale to my mom's a registered Democrat and all that nonsense, but she's like, oh, you kids and your kale. Like, we are not having kale at Thanksgiving. Oh, like she gets visibly pissed off. And I understand that. It's like, don't tell, like, just because you're into it, don't make me get into it.
Right. It's like yoga. Just leave me out of it. You know what I mean?
Have you done yoga?
You really should do yoga. Like, I don't want to do yoga. I can't touch my toes. I don't want to do yoga. But I agree. It's the total. It's a proxy
but
for something
you know,
else.
Yeah, but because
it's
you can't touch your toes, probably means you should be trying to do something.
Here we
yoga.
Go. Well, this is the problem. The preaching begins.
You know, but flexibility, you can't just go to the gym and get huge every day, Willie.
Well, can I just say, kale's become a talisman for like liberal scolding around food.
Right. Yes.
I kind of wonder, and I legitimately don't know the answer to this, if there hadn't been such a concerted effort to scold people about their food choices, would people care as much today?
Wait, what do you mean?
So like if people, you know, if there hadn't been the rhetoric and the language and the feeling of being scolded, would people actually pay attention to their food choices?
Oh, because they're getting...
I just wonder, like, was that a necessary part?
What she's saying is these rubes don't know what's good for them.
Well, no, but like,
yes and no. There's two thoughts. Two thoughts I think there's always... People don't like to hear what they don't want to hear, but a week later they're like, okay.
Exactly.
Like, they kind of come around, like, you know, someone berates you about yoga, and then a week from now, Willie's going to be going to yoga.
I just went
so
on my
obvious.
Phone to book a class.
He's going to be, like, in his unitard
and
everything.
That glow. That glow.
But so I think there's part of that, but also I do think, like, it's interesting, like, for instance... Brussels sprouts are on every menu everywhere.
That's right.
The new kale.
But that could go back to when David Chang put them on the menu at Momofuku, and they were like Brussels sprouts with like thick cut bacon and crispy and fish sauce. And people liked them because they were like delicious. And then all of a sudden other chefs started doing them because they were delicious and often with a pork product. But they sort of gained popularity without the lecture. So I think there's two ways to do it. I don't think it's bad to break people into healthiness. But also, I think you're like, oh, actually, yeah,
vegetable-centric menus are actually totally delicious.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote a piece, I'll have to look it up, a couple of years ago about the end of the big, long work lunch. Because at startups, the energy is like, order in, sit at your desk, we're working while we're eating. So that's total anathema to anyone below the age of 40, 50, maybe.
Like, even. 50. You've been
gone for 2 hours.
You're
going to go out for 2 hours and eat lunch? We're trying to get something done here. And I'm that way, too. Those long lunches feel weird.
But going out for lunch feels weird.
It feels
to me
weird.
At this point.
Yeah.
But there's still, I mean, there are vestiges of it at those certain places, like Michael's, a restaurant on East 55th,
right.
Where it's like a media lunchroom and you go there to meet someone and to be seen and like make the scene.
Yeah.
But speaking of drinking, is it true that Trump does not drink?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Has he never drunk?
His brother was a terrible alcoholic
and
died
away.
From
yeah.
it. And he said he learned from that never to drink. Said the booze killed him and he wasn't going to touch it.
I commend him for his discipline on that front, you know, like in terms of, and you also hear about how Trump is always out and about doing with the ladies and such.
Charity work? Is that what
charity
you're saying?
Work? Yeah, yeah,
doing a lot of charity work at night.
I'm going to get so many pissed off listeners. Like, really?
No, but he does. I mean, he's like at nightclub. I mean, he met Melania now Melania Trump at a nightclub. I mean, he's out.
He had dinner at Tao 10 years ago.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And to do that without booze is... Hillary Clinton is not like that. She does enjoy cocktails.
Yeah. She does. What does she enjoy? I was interested.
Cocktails. We know cocktails for sure.
She's had beer on the campaign trail. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know what her drink is. I think she has a drink.
I feel like I read somewhere that it was something involving maybe a bourbon. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But she definitely partakes. She likes hot sauce a lot as well. She carries it with her wherever
she
goes.
Does she really? Mm-hmm. Is that just like a Beyonce?
I believe that.
I do.
At a certain point, really, you say it enough, it becomes true.
And then your bag man makes sure it's always in there.
The Clinton campaign like beats this horse, that flogs this horse relentlessly, like, and Hillary has hot sauce in her bag, as if it's like the most interesting thing about her. Which leads me to believe it's true. It's just such a weird. Why would you?
Speaking of which,
they focus grouped it.
Yeah.
People love hot sauce.
Well, they do.
Well, but it actually, Adam. It makes her a little bit. I found it surprising.
Anything is surprising about Hillary that makes her seem the least bit human.
But why does hot sauce make her seem human?
The fact that you carry hot sauce, that is unusual.
That's a quirk.
I guess.
And she does not strike me as quirky.
I also think it's a thing that she likes spicy food. That just doesn't fit with a politician who's we think of as someone who's constantly poll testing and doing safe things. Like liking really spicy food would seem to be a window into.
Do you think Hillary has a royal taster who tastes all her food
first? No, I don't think so, because I don't believe the president has a royal taster. And if he did, I don't think it would be called a royal taster.
On your Twitter bio, it says you are a Tabasco enthusiast.
Oh, my God.
Do you carry?
I don't carry. Okay. There's concealed carry laws.
There's carry laws here. Well, trying to get in with carrying Tabasco to One World Trade. You saw the security down there.
It's serious. I love it. I think it's the perfect food. It got to the point, I developed an ulcer several years ago. Surprise! Because I was over-consuming alcohol and Tabasco. And like, I just would like find...
Well, that's called a Bloody Mary.
Food became just a vehicle for Tabasco.
Yeah.
Like, I could put it on white rice. And
but
I
it's
would
interesting.
It. It's
right,
the
well,
vinegar.
So you went to the school in the South. Well, you lived in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Tabasco is a very certain kind of hot sauce. It's a very vinegary one. Because now when you have Cholula, you got Sriracha, all these... I respect the institution of Tabasco, but it's not what I usually reach for first.
I don't use it a lot. I'll use it on oysters, you know?
Yeah.
I can pick that up in New Orleans maybe a little bit. But as a general rule, I don't ask the restaurant to bring over Tabasco regardless of what I'm having. I've started to do a little bit on scrambled eggs. I had a friend who did it. I was like, it's going to make those better because they're so boring.
Yeah.
I'll do a little of that. But I definitely don't carry it in my purse.
That my husband has a real issue with Tabasco sauce because he thinks it overpowers everything because that vinegar taste is so pronounced. I, of course, think that's the hallmark of goodness is that taste.
So your husband, Sam Cass, used to be the chef to the Obamas in the White House. He got very involved in food politics, which is different than food and politics, what we're talking about. When Sam heard we were doing this podcast, he's like, wait, what? Wait, what? Right. I'm like, no,
he's
Sam,
already
don't
done
worry.
The podcast.
There's nothing substantive to be discussed on this episode. But it's interesting nowadays. I feel like probably more than ever, like you can't separate food from politics. We had Jose Andres on a few weeks ago, also from D.C., and Jose got big into the issue of immigration and restaurant workers and stuff. And the listeners were not very happy about that.
The fact that he got involved?
The fact that he talked politics. But I'm like, it's hard to talk about the restaurant industry. You can't not bring that stuff up these days.
And he was at the center of the maelstrom because he was supposed to open a restaurant in the new Trump Hotel in D.C. And when Trump made the comments about Mexicans, Jose basically pulled out and he's in the middle of a lawsuit. I mean, I think politics are, I would argue that, you know, you talk about labor. Labor is inherently a political issue. It's at the base of the sort of restaurant industry. And so it's not that surprising that a restaurant owner would have ideas about labor and immigration, but doubly so for Jose because he's in the center of this whole debate.
How do you guys deal with, in terms of, because I would hope that you could have a discussion about politics without being overbearingly partisan about it, that you can talk about food policy and food politics and stuff without your listeners getting annoyed with you.
Yeah, I think they all, I mean, first of all, you have so many famous chefs now that are, they feel like it's incumbent upon them to take some sort of role in policy discussion. Like Tom Colicchio is super active talking about food policy, and he's...
And really well. Sam's one,
and
I mean,
really well.
It's not Sam.
Tom
is one of those guys who can talk about it. You're like, when he talks about food policy, I'm like, wow, you know so much more than me.
I did an event with him and Governor Christie like 3 years ago. To listen to Tom Colicchio, he was not there as a face. He wasn't there along for the ride. He was the one explaining food policy. Like, this is a huge part of his life. So I think he wears on his sleeve which side he goes. He's a Hillary Clinton supporter, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think, I'm trying to think, Anthony Bourdain I interviewed, he's in his own different way. He's outspoken about politics. So I think when you get in the public eye that way, I think most of them are associated in some way with Democrats. When you get that famous and you're asked enough questions, politics come up and you sort of get sucked into that political vortex.
But
to be clear, there are so many political issues that dovetail with the food system, whether it's climate change and environmentalism relating to sustainability and food production, whether it's immigration and labor pertaining to the workforce in the kitchen. I mean, there's whether it's
big,
economics,
big food and all that.
Taxes, you know, like all of that is housed under a restaurant.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think some of the most outspoken people, advocates on any of those issues end up being chefs.
But what I think is impressive about Tom Colicchio is that if you're going to be asked about these sort of hot button topics, you better know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm always hesitant to sort of wade in there because I'm like, I don't feel like I have a handle on this stuff well enough to even just speak in an informed way and let the listener decide. But it's tough to really know it as deeply as someone like
and
him
does. And he's deeply engaged. I mean, he watches our shows constantly. He'll send me emails. He'll send out tweets disputing something we say on the show. He's very engaged and active in the process.
And Tom spends a lot of time in Washington. Food Policy Action, which he works with, is trying to score Congress people on their positions relating to hunger and food availability in the same way that the NRA scores Congress people on their positions vis-a-vis guns and the Second Amendment. He's part of a pretty organized movement around the issues.
Can I ask you guys a question that has nothing to do with food? I want to say the first Republican debate was, I think, like 18 months ago or something, 17, 18 months ago.
The primary debate.
Primary.
Why is the election cycle this long? Because to me, it strikes me as a reality TV show, and I begin to wonder, well, maybe it just is literally a reality TV show, that it, because of CNN and MSNBC and NBC and everyone, like, they just churn it along and keep it going.
I like it in Great Britain when somebody stands up in Parliament and goes, let's have an election.
Yeah.
And then like 2 weeks later,
Canadians, right? We take 3 months, boom, start to finish, soup to nuts, and we're done. Like,
right.
But seriously, is this an American thing that it's all feeds the machine of advertising and everything else?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think if we all agreed that it should be 6 months, that would be great.
Yeah.
But you're always gonna, I mean, you get the First Amendment. People can start and do whatever they want when they want to do it. But Ted Cruz got in April of 2015. he was the first guy in
How'd
the
that
pool.
Work out?
April of 2015. So all it takes is one person starting the campaign, and the other people have to. Catch up, or you're
and then
in
I feel
too
like
late.
DC is then consumed with it for that year and a half, and nothing actually gets done in the Capitol, even more so than usual.
Nothing gets done anyway. I mean, the most legislating we're going to see is in the lame duck session. I think there are two factors that lead to an insanely, painfully long election calendar. One is, yes, the media makes a lot. I mean, you look at the numbers for this election cycle. There's a lot of money to be made in covering politics the way that we are, wall to wall, 24/7. The other, and I think this is actually more the the engine behind it is money and the fact that, you know, you want to be first out of the gate. You want to consolidate your donor base. You want to be the inevitable nominee. You want to get everyone on your side. You want all the staff, that all the best staff. I mean, there's an enormous amount of pressure to be the front runner as early as possible. And that, you know, results in dollars and support and theoretically votes. So the earlier you start, the better your chances.
And I would say the upside to it is, if you're a fan of Barack Obama, you wouldn't have had Barack Obama in a 4-month, 6-month election.
Yeah, exactly.
He was unknown. He was a relatively unknown senator. He had to build up the support,
it takes him a while
the
to
staff,
get it.
The yeah. money, and to become viable enough where mm-hmm. people say, oh, I thought I was going to vote for Hillary Clinton, yeah. but I like this guy better. He needed that time to get there. So you would lose some people.
Let me ask you
politics.
A question. Is it too late for him to get into this election?
Someone actually was like, wait, if the election is contested, does that mean Obama stays president? And I was like, I don't know your name, but that is the pipe dream.
And he quickly was like, hell no, yeah. I am out.
The bags are packed. Yeah.
All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us on the BA Foodcast. But before we go, we're going to do a little tag team lightning round.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. Wait, so tag, we're together?
Some of you'll be together. Some you will be apart. And I will let you know when you're together. We're going to start with one for Willie. Okay. Arnold's or Prince's? And we're talking about Nashville.
Yeah. I'm gonna go.
You
Arnold.
Went to Vanderbilt.
Yeah, I'm gonna go Arnold's.
That's like the meat. That's like the meat and three sort of place.
Yeah, old school meat and three.
And wait, what was like? Give me an order.
But you would do chicken fried steak, maybe something like that. Little green beans on the side.
Yep. Like green beans that have been cooked for 9 hours.
Exactly, been sitting in a pot for 3 days
with pork products.
Yeah, I will say that Arnold's is really good. There are a couple other little joints in Nashville that I would recommend.
And then Prince's is home to the famous hot chicken.
Yeah.
Do you get down with that?
Yeah, I can dance with that. I can dance with the hot chicken. Yeah.
All right, Wags, we're going to hit you one. Black or green?
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about tea, because apparently you don't drink coffee, which is beyond lame as a morning TV sort of person.
You know, I'm going to go green. It's just, I like bitter. Black tea, I always have to put milk and sugar in it.
You put any Tabasco in your green tea?
If I could, I would, man. It would probably float at the top, though.
All right, back to you, Will. Like, iced or hot?
Coffee?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, no, hot. We're not talking ice cream.
Hot,
yeah.
Hot. Yeah, always hot.
Sugar and
it's
cream?
It's part of the wake-up for me. I actually, believe it or not, did not drink coffee until about a year ago.
What?
So I did like 8 years of Morning Joe
Kabooya.
Without coffee.
Who are you people?
I know.
Why are you people?
Adam's the odd man out.
I don't know.
So I started
I'm the odd man in.
My gateway into it was I would do like a vanilla latte. I just didn't like the taste of it.
Back to you, Willie.
Yes.
Goo Goo clusters or moon pies?
This is going to be sacrilegious. I don't really love either of them, but I'm going to go with Goo Goo Cluster. Goo Goo Cluster sponsors the show Grand Ole Opry.
Oh, okay.
Has been the sponsor forever.
And that's
and
like
ever,
a peanut
ever.
Caramel
yeah,
sort
it's
of
a
deal?
It's peanut caramel. It's a chocolatey. What's it comparable to? It's not a Twix because it's got more
and
peanut
in it.
It's
not a Snickers.
It's caramel
exactly.
chocolate. Yeah. And yeah, it's
it
a little Snickers.
It doesn't have
but
a nougat.
It's harder. No.
Yeah.
But I would take that over the moon pie every time.
All right, both of you guys. Dinner with dad or drinks with dad?
Dinner with dad. Drinks with dad, we go to a far reaches of the cosmos. Dinner with dad.
And your dad was a political operative back in the day in D.C.,
yes, my father was very involved in a lot of the Democratic campaigns of the 70s and to some extent the 80s.
He knows how the sausage
was. Watcher of American politics.
He knows how the sausage was made, right?
You know, yeah, that's a weird metaphor to use in the context of my dad, but I will go with it. And he has a lot to say. I get sent a lot of exit polling data.
Oh, still.
On voting day. It's a lot.
I like a drink with my dad. There's a certain spot, Shelter Island, way out at the end of Long Island.
Yeah.
He's got a little place out there with my mom. Sit on the back deck with a drink as the sunset.
That sounds nice.
That's where it happens.
What do the Geist boys drink?
Bourbon.
Yeah. Bourbon.
Oh, yeah.
How do you take it? Wow, fancy.
Yeah, I know. It's good. My everyday bourbon is not the pappy, but if you sit with your dad on the back porch on like a Saturday in the summer, that's the. So my dad is Midwestern. He's from Champaign, Illinois.
A TV veteran.
There's a stoicism to the Midwestern man, but when you get a little drink on the back porch, it all melts away.
Yep, yeah.
That's the good stuff. Those are the good times.
Oh, a DC question. Tabard Inn or Old Ebbitt Bar and Grill?
And without question, the Tabard Inn.
Will, have you been to either?
I've been to Ebbitt,
yeah.
Right across from near the White House?
Yeah.
That's a classic old school one. Tabard's a little bit.
Tabard's a little bit
hipper, but still very old.
Yeah, and a little bit threadbare.
Yeah.
A Washington institution.
Shabby chic.
Hey, it's more on the shabby than the chic side at this point. Old Ebbett is a little touristy, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, it is, but it's one
it's
of those
also
things.
A classic.
Yeah, it's a classic, and it's big and beautiful. J.G. Mellon or Corner Bistro?
I'm thinking about the burger at Corner Bistro. Corner Bistro.
I spoke last night while eating a burger of the burger at Corner Bistro, which one of my ex-boyfriends used to refer to as his church.
Wow.
It's a pretty special place.
You were eating a burger.
Yes.
Where were you eating a burger?
I was eating a burger at a fantastic establishment called Prime Meats.
Oh, yeah.
And I was asking my table mate.
Which is a good burger.
What is your favorite burger? And he said, I don't know. I've eaten so many burgers, which was a disgusting answer as far as I'm concerned. And I said, you know, there's this place called the Corner Bistro. And I proceeded to spin the tale of this holy burger place.
Bistro is good. It used to be better. They lost some of their cooks a while back, and I think they're not as consistent as they used to be in terms of if you order medium rare, you're never really sure if you're going to get medium rare. They cook their burgers. I can go on about this under a salamander, so the flames are up top. They're on a grill. Flames from up top,
right.
So they're essentially broiled like in a kitchen in a kitchen oven. The J.G. Mellon, which is a famous old place on the Upper East Side, where you would see a lot of local politicians and such, and the mayor or whatever. They do theirs on a flat top griddle, so it's more kind of fried. But they also have the cottage fries, which are those round fries, which are awesome.
Please hammer, don't hurt them.
Yeah, so I love them both. Okay, guys, last question: butter or olive oil?
Olive oil.
Ooh. Butter.
And with that, thank you, guys. Willie Geist, Alex Wagner, our big political smackdown. Thank
Was
you.
It?
I don't know.
No.
It wasn't
very
a smackdown.
Bipartisan.
Totally a smackdown.
Very bipartisan.
No. Our political gathering.
Yeah.
Or, no. Was that
our Congress.
It's a salon.
Our Congress.
Oh, a salon. Salon. Yeah, salon. All right. Have fun at yoga.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Plus, we're now offering online cooking classes with Sir La Table that feature our recipes. Sign up at bonappetit.com/cookingclasses and learn how to make everything from pork chops to molten chocolate cake. Thanks for listening.